Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Deanna Reborn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Welcome to the What You Read Next podcast. In this podcast, your host, Lori Amin, will interview published authors to chat about their work, journey to getting published, and their book recommendations. If you share a passion for books and are always looking for your next read, then join us. Welcome to the What You Read Next podcast. Today's guest is Hannah Bergerman. Her latest book, If Only I Could Tell You, was September's Book of the Month pick. In this episode, we chat about her writing process, her journey to publishing, and finally, rounded book recommendations. Now let's get to the show. Hi, Hannah. Welcome to What You Read Next podcast.
Thank you so much for having me, Laura.
So happy to have you here. So tell us a little bit about yourself.
I am a writer and a journalist, and I live in London. I was previously a commissioning editor in television for about 15 years for the BBC and for Discovery America. And about 5 years ago, I had a career swap, wrote my first book, started doing literary journalism, and now chair and interview lots of people at festivals and events, lots of writers, review books, write features, do interviews with people, and write novels.
I love it. So you're a journalist. How much does your work relate to your writing of writing novels?
Well, it's, I mean, obviously it's all connected because most of my journalism is book related. So I review a lot, but also I do interviews with authors. And to be honest, it's a bit like I'm getting paid to learn loads because I tend to try and interview authors who I love and whose work I really admire. And so I feel like a lot of the time I'm just getting a kind of private masterclass in how they write and how they develop characters and plot and everything else. So it's wonderful because it's always amazing to talk to writers who you really admire. But also I do feel like it's a bit of a cheat because I'm getting paid to do something which is actually helping me in the rest of my job as well.
I love it. So when it's hard to become a writer?
What inspired me to become a writer? I guess being a reader first and foremost. I was a little bookworm when I was a child. My mum used to take us to the library every week, and we would get our 6 books out from the library, and I would devour them all in a week, and then we'd go back the next week and get our next 6. So I think most writers probably start as readers, and I had that really strong sense from a very really early age that books were a place that you could lose yourself and you could find yourself. And I guess in a way, sort of my whole career in a way has been about storytelling, because all the time I was in TV, it was about telling stories. I was in documentaries, but obviously you're still telling a story. So I guess it's just always been about stories and storytelling for me.
Yes, I love it. I think that's like, you start as a reader, you start learning all those different stories, and then you get inspired to share your stories or share other people's story. Yeah.
And I think, I mean, I don't know how true this is for all other writers, but I think certainly for me, there's a certain amount of kind of, I mean, I'm not necessarily therapy, but there's definitely a certain amount of kind of working through things that you are preoccupied with or thinking about or feeling stuff about. And I find that the way that I work through lots of things that interest me or intrigue me or preoccupy me is either talking kind of one-on-one with someone or writing something. So I think there's definitely that element too.
Yes. So you live in Bangladesh. What was the experience like?
Yeah, I lived in Bangladesh for 2 years, from 2009 to 2011. It was fascinating. I mean, it's an incredibly poor country, obviously, but it's got this kind of vibrant industry coming up. Obviously, it's got like a huge garment industry, but it's a very difficult place to live because it's incredibly crowded. As I say, there's incredible poverty there, and it's just a real culture shock, in all honesty. As I say, I was there for 2 years, and it was a good few months before anything started feeling normal. And weirdly, then when you come back, you get this kind of reverse culture shock, and everything back in London feels really, really weird for a few months, and it takes time to settle back in with family and friends and life back here. I mean, I moved out there, I fell in love, And I was in love with, was a British diplomat, and he was moving out there, and we did the whole like long distance relationship thing for about a year, and then I got a job with the BBC out there and moved out. So it was in some ways it was just like truly wonderful, because it was us sort of really jumping into the deep end together, and having only really dated for about 3 months in London before he moved, suddenly I'm moving the world to be with him, and we were living together, and it was all quite intense. So in that way it was a wonderful experience, and we did lots of travel from there, so every kind of 6 weeks or so, because it was a very intense place to live, so we would try and travel about every sort of 6 weeks or so. So we would, you know, just zip off to China or Hong Kong or the Middle East, and so yeah, it was amazing. It was an amazing time.
That's great. So you're a published author of multiple books. What was your journey to get your first book published?
So I started writing my first book actually when we'd come back from Bangladesh, and when I got pregnant, and I had quite a tricky pregnancy, so I couldn't, it was quite difficult for me to kind of go out and work. So, and I'd always had this budding idea to write a book. So I thought, well, if this isn't the time, then when is going to be the time when I'm at home? And so I wrote a really, really, really detailed outline. I had a really strong sense of what I wanted that book to be. And I wrote about the first three chapters, and I sent them off to about four agents here in London. And two of them didn't reply. One of them said, show me the manuscript when you finished. And the other one said, come and meet me for lunch tomorrow. I want to represent you. So it was that kind of dream phone call. And so that agent worked with me on the manuscript, and I wrote it in like a record time. It was about 6 months. It was just kind of, I think there was some kind of weird pregnancy hormonal thing going on. I would write for 12 hours a day, I wasn't on social media at the time, so I literally wouldn't look up from my screen for 12 hours. And I just wrote it in this kind of mad frenzy of, I've got to get this book done before I give birth. And it sold like 2 weeks before I was due to give birth. And so that was my journey.
That's amazing. I love it. Let's talk about your writing. Do you follow an outline, or do you see where the story leads you?
I tend to have a kind of five-act structure when I start. So I know I know sort of what my big beats are. My agent always sort of, we always talk about how you sort of, particularly in the kind of fiction that I write, you need to have those kind of big moments at the end of each section that you are really making the reader want to carry on and really want making kind of find out what's happened. So I do have a kind of loose plot structure, but I mean, to be honest, I would call myself an iterative writer. So the if only I could tell you was 24 drafts. So the first draft bears absolutely no relation to the book that will finally end up in the reader's hands, because I draft and redraft and redraft, and on each of those rewritings I kind of delve deeper and deeper and deeper into the characters and get to know them more and figure out what's going on. I mean, honestly, at the beginning I sort of have a scenario and I don't really know why any character's doing anything that they're doing, and by writing and writing and writing over multiple drafts I figure out what on earth is going on with them. So it's a bit like, I mean, the way that I describe it, it's a bit like being a psychotherapist, and these characters turn up and sit on my couch and describe these situations to me, and over the course of multiple sessions I dig deeper and deeper and find out what's gone on and what trauma they've had and what upset they've had and why they're behaving in this dysfunctional way they are.
I love it. So the characters evolve as you write it. So you may have an idea at the beginning, but then, you know, as you just develop more and more, you start to find the real story.
Exactly. Exactly that.
So how do you organize yourself as a writer? How do you keep track of ideas, inspirations, characters, or just future books?
I'm a great fan of Google Keep, which is a brilliant, as it's just like an app on my phone where every time I think of something I write it down, even if it's the middle of the night. I am someone who has scribbles on every bit of paper around the house, so whenever I'm reading something, I always have like a piece of A4 paper folded into a book so that I can make notes as I'm reading. And on nearly every single one of those, for every book for about the last 5 years, there will also be notes of books that I, you know, ideas for books, or even just like a one line for a character that I'm writing at the moment. So I scribble a lot on lots of pieces of paper, and most of them get lost and I have no idea what I've written and when. So yeah, I wouldn't say I'm fantastically organized, but Google Keep definitely is my savior, because I can, if something comes into my head, I will try and kind of like scribble it down on that. And then I have, you know, 24 documents on Google Keep that have various ideas for different things, whether it be, as I say, just like a couple of lines for a book that I'm already writing, or a thought about a future book or a future story.
I love Google Keep. I think for me, it's like a great place to just dump, you know, those inspirations that just come up and, you know, come up in your head and you're like, oh, that would be a great idea. And just putting it down, and it's great. It's a great app on the phone. So it's easy. It's convenient.
Yeah. And the fact that you can share it. So like, you know, I use it for my kind of like general life admin quite a lot as well. What do we need in the larder this week?
Yeah, that's true. So do you share your work along the way, or do you wait until it's completed for others to read?
Oh, you know, I will, in an ideal world, I would probably be on about draft 10 before I show anyone. I have two really good writer friends who tend to be my first readers, and I trust them implicitly. They will give me, because we are all writers, they will give me very frank and very honest feedback, however difficult that might be to take. And we do it for each other, so we will read each other's kind of early drafts. And then I kind of have like a series of beta readers after that. So there's a group of about five or six people who I trust to be honest, but in a kind way. But generally I will try to get to a place where I don't know what else to do with it. I know that there might be issues, but I don't know quite how to fix them. Or I might not even know what the issues are. I just know that there are issues, and that something's not quite right working, or it's not ready, or I've just done as much as I can for the time being. And then I will hand it on to someone else and say, can you, you know, just give me your initial feedback and what bits aren't working for you and what bits are, which hopefully there are, even in an early draft.
Yeah, that's true. I think the feedback helps to kind of like just shape the story. But sometimes the units just need to keep writing for the story to shape, to come to fruition.
I think it's quite common that lots of writers say, I don't really want to hand something over until I just don't know what else to do with it.
Yeah.
Almost like you have to be sick of redrafting and thinking about it yourself, and you need someone else's kind of energy and input into it. And it's funny, I mean, I often find, particularly with my very first reader, who's a British writer called Lucy Atkins, and she is also a journalist as well, like a book critic as well. And I often find that she will read it and she will just say one thing about something that's not working. And then I will just have this whole kind of outpouring of things that I know are suddenly wrong. And it's almost like someone else reading it and just pointing out two or three things is a really wonderful catalyst for you to start articulating and realizing the stuff that you want to do with it.
That's so powerful.
Yeah, she I hope we will always be friends, because I will always need her.
Yes, I would love to. I think it would be great for your future books. So that's great. So congratulations. If only I could tell you, being a book of the month selection, that's really fantastic.
I mean, like, people have been so lovely, and you know, just on Instagram and people reaching out and saying, you know, giving me feedback and saying what they thought of it. It has been a really kind of like genuinely heartwarming experience being on Book of the Month.
That's really great. So I am a Book of the Month member. So that was my pick for September.
Thank you. Delighted.
Yeah. So if only I could tell you, as a family story where two sisters are strange and we spend most of the show on covering the estrangement. When's prior to write about this family?
The book actually started with Audrey, who is the girl's mother. Mm-hmm. And it started with the idea of this woman who, Audrey is 63, and I started with the idea of this woman who is, we know, is dying right at the outset of the book, and who has some issue in her family that she wants to resolve before she dies. As I started kind of thinking deeper about what that was going to be, I realised that she was going to have two daughters, and they were going to be, and each of them were going to have two daughters, i.e. the elder woman's granddaughters, who had never been allowed to meet. So suddenly we had this three generations of women's story where Audrey doesn't know the cause of her daughter's estrangement. And so there's this idea of the toxicity of secrets that kind of trickle down through the generations. And that just really intrigued me. I love the idea of secrets generally. And I, you know, we have this kind of in Britain, I don't know whether you have the same thing in America, but this idea that if you don't talk about things in families, they just disappear and they just go away. So there's like this really said, soon is mended, as though if you don't talk about things, they will just disappear into the ether and they don't exist. And of course, that's nonsense. If there are issues between like any people in any relationships, but particularly in families, they will find their way of wheeling their way out, whether it's, you know, people being unable to have other fulfilling relationships, or whether people being self-sabotaging in other areas of their life. Those kind of dysfunctions in families will find their way out in some kind of symptom or another. And that's what I wanted to explore, was the idea that there is this, there are these characters who are keeping a secrets from each other. There is this enormous rift at the center of a family, which has ruptured this family. Mm-hmm. And I want to see the impact on everybody of that estrangement, and how keeping secrets from one another impacts on your life in ways that you don't even realize at the time until afterwards when it's all resolved.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the whole idea of the secret, the whole idea of the estrangement, the generations, what's what kept me going reading the book. I was curious at the beginning. I was like, why are they estranged? You know, there's this event that happens and it seems innocuous, and then somehow it snowballs into this major life transforming event that occurs to the story of the characters. And so for me, I just kept going. I just kept reading, and then just seeing how the secret, you know, how the estrangement, the secrets were, you know, not just affected the main three characters, but also their daughters, and how they all were involved in it. You know, it was just one of those books that are just like, I just couldn't stop reading.
Well, that is wonderful to hear, and I'm delighted that you couldn't stop reading it. Yeah, I mean, the family estrangement angle, it's something that I've written about here in the UK, and I wrote a piece for NBC last week about it in relation to Meghan Markle and her dad. And I think it's one of those things that is incredibly common. I mean, statistically, we know it's incredibly common. But it's something that I think people feel really ashamed about. And it has been genuinely overwhelming since the book published in the UK in February. And even since the NBC article ran and the Book of the Month has been out, I've had literally thousands of messages from people saying, I have this estrangement in my family and I've never wanted to talk to anyone about it because I felt ashamed, and because I thought every other family around me is perfect and we're the only family that have this horrible rift or this horrible rupture at the heart of it. And actually it's incredibly common. And I think part of the reason that we don't talk about it is because we feel like there's some sense of failure if our family isn't perfect. And the reality is there is no such thing as a perfect family. We all have our flaws and we all have our fallouts and our arguments and our disagreements. And sometimes those disagreements become much more profound. It's been really interesting. It's been kind of really humbling that so many people, both on Twitter and on like through my website, have been sharing stories that they said they've never shared with people, even friends before, because they just didn't feel like it was a kind of socially appropriate thing to talk about.
Yeah, I think, and I too have an estrangement in my life, and that's something that I feel like when I share with others, there's like a shame around it. There's a sense of, or other people's opinions, like, why you have it, you know, your reasons, what are your reasons for it? And it's like, well, it's just a personal reason why I choose to have an estrangement. But there's an expectation that you shouldn't have this, that this is something to be shamed.
Yeah, and I think there's the idea that kind of like family is family and you should be kind of close to them and tolerate anything at any cost, even if it's very bad for you and very toxic for you, is really damaging, actually. Because, I mean, it's interesting, I think, you know, we've now culturally got to a point where if you're in a romantic relationship with someone who is being controlling or toxic or abusive, we all accept now that you should say to your friend, you know, get out of that relationship, it's not good for you. And yet somehow with family, we think that those relationships should persist whatever the story and whatever the impact on you. I'm sorry that you are also in a situation where you have an estrangement, because it's not easy. And I think that lots of people think that if you have an estrangement in your family, it's because you're intolerant and because you are impatient and you just haven't, you know, learned to deal with, you know, nuances in relationships. Most of the people that I've ever spoken to that have an estrangement in their family, and I have one in mine, it's a long, slow, painful process to become estranged. You don't just suddenly wake up one day and say, well, that person's annoyed me a bit, so I'm never going to speak to them again. The way I've described it before in pieces is, for me, I was estranged from my dad for 25 years before he died. And it's like a kind of slow, painful death, but with the relationship. But yet it's weird because you know that this person is still alive and they're existing in this kind of parallel world that you don't have any connection to. And yet the relationship itself has died and you have to mourn that relationship. And I think it's an incredibly kind of complex emotional situation to go through that I think is kind of hugely understood, and lots of people can be very judgmental about it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think the judgment is what irks me the most, you know. And I used to say it was a slow process. It wasn't like an overnight, like I chose to. This took years of therapy to realize, like, this is the best, this is what how I set boundaries, this is how I actually can take care of myself, as opposed to trying to make sure that I have the perfect family, the perfect you for the world to see.
Yeah, and at the end of the day, I don't think most people, if they stood back, even when they were being judgmental, if they stood back from the conversation they were having with you and you said to them, would you rather I was in a situation that is emotionally or psychologically harmful to me, or would you rather I extricate myself from it? Obviously, most people would say, well, obviously, I should extricate yourself. But there is something about that cultural pull of the family that makes it very unpalatable, I think, for some people.
Yeah. So the heart of the story is about grief that this family has gone over, a loss that they suffer. How much of the grief contributed to the estrangement of the sisters?
I mean, I think it's at the heart of it. I mean, I think the trouble with this family is they didn't talk about things when things needed to be talked about. Mm-hmm. That's kind of one of the other sort of key themes is that. Again, it's not just about keeping secrets from one another, even though all the characters are keeping pretty big secrets from each other. It's the idea that if you don't talk about things that need to be spoken about within a family, people will come up with their own. You know, it's that thing with children that people often think children don't notice anything and they don't understand what's going on. Well, of course they do. Children pick up on a million different nuances and things that they are not actually being told about in families all the time. And if we don't explain to them why people are upset or there's difficult conversations or there's whispered conversations going on, that they will make up their own stories. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the other things that I wanted to explore, the stories that we concoct to fill the space where the truth is, or the truth should be.
Yeah, I think most of the story, you know, most of the story center around, you know, half truths that just kind of like, then you just fill in the gaps and you're like, okay, this is what I think it happened, this is my fault, or this is her fault, or this is what's happening on the situation, when the reality is that if they talked about it, they communicated, they would have seen a very different story.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's about the idea that communication, as you say, can sometimes be very painful and very difficult in the moment. Mm-hmm. But the long-term impact of not communicating is far more dangerous.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So thank you so much for writing this book.
Thank you for doing it and for having me on the podcast.
Yeah. So now let's go to a round of book recommendations. This is an opportunity to share with our audience what to read next. So what's your favorite genre?
I was trying to think of this. I don't really have a favorite genre as such. I mean, the books that I like reading best are beautifully written books about families and relationships. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know if that's a genre in itself. Yeah. I guess I, you know, stylistically, I veer towards book club fiction and literary fiction. But it's interesting, you know, there's often quite a lot of snobbishness around books or novels around family. Kind of, it's sort of domestic and small and unimportant. And to my mind, family is where we all learn or fail to learn how to negotiate and how to be with other people and how to love and be loved. And that completely sort of dictates the kind of adult we're going to be. And so for me, family is the kind of real microcosm of the kind of society we will end up in. And I think family dynamics for that reason are just fascinating.
That's awesome. Who's your favorite author?
Am I allowed two?
Yes, you are.
Okay. Elizabeth Strout, who I think is nothing short of a genius, and Maggie O'Farrell, who is a British-Irish writer. And I don't know actually whether she publishes much in the States, but if she doesn't, then I heartily recommend you all go and find copies online of her backlist, because she is just a wonderful, wonderful writer.
Yeah, I read her memoir actually. So lovely.
It's amazing. I am. Has seen Brushes with Death. Yeah, it's an incredible memoir.
Yeah, so that's awesome.
But all of her novels are worth reading too.
Yeah, so it's curious. Like, I want to get her backlist. So thank you for reminding me. So what are your top three favorite books of all time?
Oh, well, I'm going to go, I have to go with an Elizabeth Strout. And I would really struggle with which is my favorite, because I have just read, and in fact, just filed today, review copy for her new book, which comes out, in fact, the same day as If Only I Could Tell You. Her new novel is Olive Again, which is just incredible. But actually, for me, I think my favorite one of hers is My Name is Lucy Barton, which is just an intense mother-daughter experience of a novel. I mean, it's just amazing. Maggie O'Farrell, obviously, and of hers I would pick The Vanishing Act of Esme Lennox, which is, I defy anyone to read that book in more than a single sitting, because you are so immersed in the characters and you are so immersed in that story, it's just impossible not to kind of just want to stay with it. And I think in a kind of sort of, I haven't read this book years, but The History of Love by Nicole Krauss, I remember just so loving when it came out, and it's one of those books that stayed with me for a very long time.
That sounds awesome. What has been a book that you read this year that you love?
Well, I've just mentioned it. I mean, my book of the year will be Olive Again by Elizabeth Strout. It is, if you read Olive Kitteridge, which she published, I think, 2009 or 2008 in the States, I think. And obviously it was made into a TV series with starring Frances McDormand. And it's a series, it's a novel, but it's a series of interconnected stories about this woman, Olive Kitteridge, who is cantankerous and formidable and opinionated, and in so many ways kind of not likable, and yet somehow Elizabeth Strout makes you love her. And and this is following Olive sort of 10 years later as she heads into proper old age. And it is just full of, you know, Elizabeth Strout does this thing so brilliantly, which is she takes the microcosms of every day and makes them important. And this book is filled with compassion and hope and her musings on like loneliness and grief and mortality. But it is just, I will be amazed if it's not on every newspaper's book of the year list come December.
I'm really going to pick it up. So thank you. Thank you so much. So tell us where we can find you online.
Okay. On Twitter, I am Hannah Beckerman. And on Instagram and Facebook, I am Hannah Beckerman Author.
Awesome. Thank you, Hannah, for being on the show.
Laura, thank you so much for having me. It's been such a pleasure. And thank you so much for being so kind about the book.
Thank you, Hannah, for a great interview. For show notes and the list of books mentioned in this podcast, please visit whattoreadnextblog.com. Thank you so much for listening. We'll be back next week with another author interview. Have a great week.
Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What to Read Next podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatyoureadnextblog.com/sponsorships to learn more, or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship or package for you. Thank you much for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.